From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's show, when should police be able to keep body camera video from the public?
That's the issue here, is the public's right and need to know versus times when there's a right to personal privacy.
The nuclear industry says don't blame them that there's no good place to put high-level nuclear waste.
It is not the industry's best choice, but rather the government's failure that has brought us to that point.
And political action committees are known for powerful, rich interests, which makes a new PAC in Michigan a little different.
There were college students that walked up to the Equity PAC table and took the change out of their pockets and handed it to us and said, whatever it takes, we want to give.
Plus, another artisan of Michigan.
I have used toilet wax in here. We've melted it down. And the good thing about it is it acts as a sealant, but it also acts as a lubricant.
Try to guess what that guy is repairing. But first, here's the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. For more than 40 years, royalties from oil and mineral rights on state of Michigan-owned land have gone to the Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund. The trust fund is controlled by a nonpartisan board. It uses the money to buy parkland and to help cities and counties develop public recreation areas. More than 30 years ago, voters passed a constitutional amendment that barred the legislature from raiding that fund. Republican State Senator Darwin Boer says the trust fund board refused to fund some development, but there's plenty of money. He wants to spend $7.7 million more of the trust fund that's reserved to pay for 43 projects the board did not approve. Here to talk about that is the director of the Department of Natural Resources, Keith Cray. Senator Boer says the trust fund has hit the maximum amount of money it's allowed. It's earning interest on that $500 million. The trust fund board did not spend all of it, and he wants to fund these other projects. What's wrong with that?
I'd back up just a second. Some people call it a cap, but really it was once the trust fund hit $500 million, an interest in earnings of those dollars could go for acquisition and development. And so the trust fund board, it's highly professional, nonpartisan, has individuals on it that run foundations for a living, like Steve Hamp, who runs the Ford Foundation. And so what the trust fund board is attempting to do is to maintain the buying power of the trust fund over time.
Bridge Magazine's Ron French reported on this. He found that these 43 projects that the senator wants to fund have been requested by cities and counties. Senator Boer says there's no reason not to fund these recreational developments. So why did the trust fund board not fund them?
The financial policy, if you will, of the trust fund board currently is we try to get a 5% return on our investment and have a 2.5% expenditure strategy. So the trust fund board has to pay all the assessments, property taxes, staff costs, review costs, closing fees, and as your public knows, those fees go up, so you need to maintain those dollars and the buying powers of those dollars.
We talked to Senator Boer's office. The argument he's making is that there are 199 projects that have not been completed, some of them dating back to 2009. The senator says those recreational developments should be finished. So I know you're talking about trying to maintain the fund, but why would these projects be left hanging?
So anyone who's ever done a construction project knows that there are things that happen to delay construction projects. So let's start with the fundamentals. 88% of the projects are done. So now we're now talking about 12% of the projects. Those are primarily local projects. As the legislature delays funding for projects, people actually lose construction cycles. So if you, in the best case scenario, have the legislature approve the project in June, and then you have to go through title searches, closings, and making sure you still have the money available, it's probably the fall. So you've lost an entire construction season. It is not abnormal to have projects that are out there for longer than a year. And in fact, we work with directly with the community so that the communities are not at risk.
The senator told Bridge Magazine that the legislature has a responsibility to make sure these projects are funded if the money is available. The legislature does have to approve the trust fund board's recommendations and appropriate the money. So why shouldn't the legislature tack on these projects if it sees fit?
Well, the Constitution is very specific. It's projects recommended by the board, and the appropriation process, which the senator is right, is under the purview of the legislature. But the recommendation process is under the purview of the board. It's very clear in the Constitution, and that's one of the problems with Senate Bill 280.
The legislature has tried to raid the Natural Resources Trust Fund a couple of times in recent years. The Attorney General says it is unconstitutional, as you mentioned. What happens if the legislature actually approves Senator Boer's bill?
Well, that's yet to be seen. First, I do have faith in the process, and part of what the senator's asking for is a public vetting to see if there are problems with the trust fund and if there's ways for it to be more efficient and expedient. And that's a fair conversation to have.
What else about this bill concerns you?
The only other part of Senate Bill 280 that the senator is attempting to do is to have the DNR apply to the trust fund, get turned down by the trust fund in order for us to be able to purchase land, which that means that duck hunters who are paying a duck stamp for wetlands for high-end recreational values or managed state game areas, we would be prohibited from doing that unless we went and competed directly with local units of governments, got turned down, and then we could do that. So that delays the process probably 18 months. Doesn't make policy sense.
Hang on, you're going to have to walk me through that again. Break it down for me.
Yeah, so what Senate Bill 280 says, it's right in front of me, so yeah, it says, except for land purchase entirely from funding from a land exchange facilitation fund, the department shall not acquire land in this state with funding from any source. That means fish and game sources, that means land and conservation sources, unless the department has first submitted an application for funding from the trust fund, and the funding from the trust fund has been denied. So that then means that, you know, the state agency will be in direct competition with many small local units of government. And with all due respect, I'd say our sophistication on grant writing might be more than a small town in the eastern end or western end of the UP. And so there's a couple constitutional issues. And then there's a couple policy issues. So I think the senator's aim is to severely restrict the department's ability to purchase land. So if something came up along Lake Michigan, high-end sand dune, high-end access site, we could not purchase it with other funds unless I was first turned down by the trust fund.
If this is passed, is the governor likely to veto it?
Yes. Don't put me on the air with that one.
I would like to tell you it's too late.
Well, that's okay. I guess it'd be okay to say that this governor does support natural resources and he does support the thoughtful implementation. You can never anticipate fully what will happen during the process, but as is, we oppose the legislation.
Keith Cray is the director of the Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for talking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lester.
As I mentioned during the interview, we reached out to Senator Boer's office and talked with a staff member there who talked with us about the senator's position. The 117th edition of the New York International Auto Show is in full swing. Paul Eisenstein is covering it. He's the publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. I saw you wrote that sports and muscle cars are taking center stage at this year's event, and I guess that Dodge Challenger SRT Demon is getting a lot of attention. 840 horses, 0 to 60 in 2.3 seconds. Wow, that's fast. But are there other performance vehicles worth noting?
What's really interesting is how many of them come in the form of SUVs. So, for example, you've got the, also from Fiat Chrysler, you've got the Jeep Grand Cherokee Trackhawk. It uses the V8 that we found in the old Dodge Challenger Hellcat. 700 horsepower is not bad.
I saw you wrote about Tesla adding a semi-truck and planning later a pickup. Elon Musk, he's not timid. What do we know about those vehicles?
Is there a market for it is the big question. We're going to have to wait and see exactly what he can accomplish. One of the challenges will be cost. Another will be range. Certainly for semi-trucks, trying to go cross-country will be almost impossible today. The pickup truck, we're hoping it will at least come in at 200-plus miles in range. So we're expecting to see the semi-truck in September or earlier, and we're expecting to see the pickup truck on the road within about 2 years.
You wrote that there's been talk about President Trump's border tax, which he says is keeping auto manufacturing here. What's being said about the idea of border tax there at the New York Auto Show?
That it won't happen.
Really? Why?
I'm sorry, this sounds political. Nobody believes it will happen. The cost, the impact on the auto industry, the impact in terms of rising prices on cars, is just unacceptable as it is on smartphones and everything else, politically untenable.
Because of consumer backlash?
Yeah, definitely. There already is clear feedback from consumers that there is a consumer backlash. They just don't want to see this. And I don't think that there's enough members of Congress that would be willing to approve that sort of tax. So that's one thing. Many of the things that he's talking about with the auto industry seem to be more vaporware than anything else. I was told, for example, the other day that some folks at Toyota got the message from the White House asking them to make it sound like the big $1.3 billion investment that they are putting into their Kentucky plant was a result of the president's position on American manufacturing. In fact, as the Toyota people stressed to me, nonsense.
There was a tweet to that effect.
Yes, and it's a lie. I'm sorry. I'm gonna stop with the phrases mistruth or misspoken. It was an outright lie. The reality is that plan has been in the works for years. You don't make billion-dollar plans in a matter of weeks or months. That plan was in the works from the time they began the development of an all-new platform, a global platform for the next generation Camry that has been underway for as much as 5 or 6 years. The basic plans for that factory, that investment, have been in place specifically for as much as 2 years, was approved by the Toyota board before the election. One has to call this out. The president is wrong. So far, I've only been able to determine that possibly a couple hundred car jobs may have been brought back to the United States by manufacturers saying, okay, let's give them a bone.
That's Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com, and he's at the New York Auto Show. Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In Grand Rapids, there's a new PAC, a political action committee. PACs are formed all the time by politicians, industry groups, and others to raise money for candidates. A group of concerned citizens, grassroots-level folks, decided if they were going to have any voice in government and policy, they needed a PAC, too. Joining me are now our Equity PAC board members, Jeremy Moore and Danavia Moje. What prompted this idea?
Well, you know, it actually started about a year ago, a little bit over a year ago, Lester, in December of 2015. The city commission here in Grand Rapids had voted on allowing for long rifles to be in different police cars, in the GRPD police cars. And that was something that there was some promise around having some sort of community or public discussion on this issue for several years. And the issue was is that this was voted on without any kind of public engagement. And there was a lot of concern, in particular in communities of color, that crime had been going down for nationally and at a local level for 20, 30 years pretty consistently. And there was confusion as to why there needed to be kind of a buildup of arms with the Grand Rapids Police Department. And what we found was that we just were sick of going to politicians with their hats in our hand asking for them to listen. And so we said, you know, I think we can start our own political action committee that's going to be able to try to advance more equitable policy and put more equitable candidates in place.
Why go this route rather than simply creating an activist or advocacy organization?
Well, you know, actually, we're both. We don't think we're going to win the money game, but we do think we're going to win the people game. So part of what we do is we need to be able to not only fundraise to be able to contribute to campaigns, but also we mobilize time as well. So last October, leading up to the election, we had endorsed 8 different candidates. And we, in October, mobilized 300 hours to go out from our PAC. And this is early on. We mobilized 300 hours from our PAC of people to go out and knock on doors to be able to canvass for them. Not only are we going to be doing canvassing, now we're adapting issues and actually funding organizing through the PAC so that we can address things like police reform, immigration justice, affordable housing. And in particular, we just launched diversity of governance.
I definitely echo his sentiment. I think for us, we recognize that a PAC is uniquely a fundraising tool. And when you want to move the needle, a lot of times you do have to write a check. That's what appeals to a lot of candidates, not only the ability to fund their campaign, but also to have people that will come behind them and canvas. And so we decided we had to do both.
So you've talked about people, you've talked about money. How many people are involved with Equity PAC?
Right now, we have a little over 170 individuals. We kind of set these goals for ourselves in the beginning, like, you know, it'd be really nice to try and get 200 members by the end of 2017. And, you know, since we've been having meetings and really being out in the community, what we found is that there was a much greater response to this than we had originally anticipated. It's like we're going to knock that goal out the park because we have a lot of people that have joined our email list, that have donated to our PAC, and have just really been passionate about advancing equity in the community. And so what that's looked like is we have people that are making calls, doing phone banking. We have drop-in meetings where people can come and talk to police officers, and they can come talk to candidates that they've endorsed, and people show up, and it's just been extraordinary.
So there's the people side. What about the money side?
We've definitely leveraged a lot of money as well, which is nice. We're looking at over $20,000 raised right now, which is really exciting for us. I think originally it was like maybe five of us at the end of March. I said, hey, let's just start asking people know for money.
We're going to start texting people and seeing if they'll give to this.
Let's just see who could give to this. And through November, I'd say we raised around $12,000. But right after the election, we had an even broader response in terms of fundraising, people that were seeing how serious this work was and how important it was to become a part of this. And that's been incredible.
Who's giving? Who's the typical person, typical donor to the PAC?
You know, it's everyone. And to be completely honest, I was trying to explain this to my mother, too. I'm like, you know, we had a meeting at Equity Drinks and we said, hey, we want to, by the time we leave this room, we want to raise $5,000. And people put out their phones. There were college students that walked up to the Equity PAC table and took the change out of their pockets and handed it to us and said, whatever it takes, we want to give. I think that's what's been incredible. It's everybody. It's not just a particular person, but we've seen a lot of progressives. We've seen a lot of working class individuals. But what we hope as we grow and expand is to actively kind of recruit a more of the average Joe like me. I'm a full-time college student, a single mother, and I think people just like me can come to Equity PAC and give whatever they've got.
We also value time and money equally. So for people who can't give money necessarily, the membership is $50 or you pledge 10 hours to put towards, you know, whatever issues that you're interested in within the PAC. So we value those things equally, and we really feel that creates an equitable framework for membership.
And we have members that do both, quite frankly. And then when we say, hey, we'd love for you to pledge some volunteer hours, they will pledge above the 10, which is just the minimum. And I think that's the wonderful response that we've gotten all over.
Before I go to my next question, Equity Drinks, what is that? How often is that held?
Yeah, so Equity Drinks was this once-a-month forum where people could come together and talk about issues in the community, concerns, and sometimes it featured different speakers, but it typically happened at a bar or a place where people could buy drinks, and essentially you'd get a drink and talk about equity. That created a really awesome space here in Grand Rapids for people to kind of start having these conversations. But what we learned is that here in Grand Rapids, people are very comfortable having the conversation. The problem comes with when you're trying to actually move the needle politically, you got to stop talking about how frustrating it is and actually do more. And the PAC was, you know, that activist arm, that ability to actually, you know, impact change, politically speaking.
It sounds like you're approaching people who really haven't been all that involved with government before. How do you persuade them that they can make a difference by giving to a political action committee?
Yeah, that we found was a really big gap in West Michigan. I can't speak for, you know, Michigan as a whole, but there really was no kind of political voice that was taken by a lot of the folks that would come to Equity Drinks. This was a new space, and I think people were really hungry for it. As Danavia said, you know, when we first started, it was kind of this, you know, we have a pretty big network among ourselves. Can we start engaging people? And it grew so quickly, even before the election, and then after the election, with all the concerns about what's happening at a national level and the downstream results of that coming into our cities and counties. I think there's a lot of recognition that this is something that's needed at a local level because those politicians, the folks that we're trying to elect or hold accountable, are the people that are standing in between us and Washington, D.C., and they're the ones who are going to have to address the issues that are coming downstream.
Let me ask you this question. What are the priorities for Equity PAC?
So there's actually five priorities, and the first that we just launched last month is around diversity of government, immigration justice, police reform, affordable housing, and then voter education.
How'd you arrive at those five?
After the election, we really felt like it was time to regroup, given the fact that there was such a drastic turn in the national discourse. So we spent some time doing public meetings with our membership and also putting out surveys to get a sense of where were people's concerns given the national and the local environment, and those were the five that were emerged.
When you say local efforts, what levels of government are you primarily concerned about?
We focus on a couple different levels. So the city of Grand Rapids, the county level, so Kent County, but also surrounding areas like Kentwood and the city of Wyoming as well. We're concerned about things like the diversity of government. So, for instance, the city of Grand Rapids, their government workforce is 90% white, even though that doesn't reflect the overall demographics of the city. And we have serious concerns about that.
What are the demographics?
Grand Rapids right now is currently around 60% white.
But the police force is 90% white.
Oh, yeah, the police force as well as the overall workforce for the entire city, actually.
Yep. And those are the kinds of demographic issues that are reminiscent of places like Ferguson, where the demographics of the city changed very rapidly and the city workforce didn't. And it creates all sorts of conflict points. And we're concerned about that. And we're seeing that at the county level. We're seeing that at the city level. And we're seeing that at different units of government surrounding the city. And so that's our first effort, is how can we diversify not just the workforce, but also the governance. The county and the city alone have 500 appointed positions that we can see. There's no effort to diversify those different areas.
How will you go about selecting the candidates that you want to support?
What we started with was essentially making a candidate endorsement application. And the way that process has worked is originally a candidate emailed or even reached out to us and received the application. And it kind of serves as a little bit of a litmus test where we just kind of say, how do you feel about these key policy issues? And then also, how do you advance equity in your particular office? I think originally we wanted to, you know, see every candidate share all of our views in so many different buckets. We talked about criminal justice and the environment and healthcare and education. And then we realized that, you know, we got to make this applicable to the person applying for our endorsement. And so we essentially ask, how does your office advance equity? You know, if you're running for county clerk, then maybe we want to hear your views on voting rights. If you're running for the drain commissioner, we maybe want to hear your views on the environment, not as much on voting rights. And so that's kind of how we made that really applicable. And once they apply, the board gets together and we essentially just kind of look and see, you know, if over, you know, I'd say 80% of these responses kind of line up with what our expectations were. We don't vote to endorse you. You come before our membership at our membership endorsement meeting, and the members of Equity PAC vote yay or nay on endorsing you.
I hate to throw cold water on this whole issue, but given that other PACs are backed by really big money, contributions are reliably routine in politics from certain elements in our society, how much influence do you think you guys will really have?
I think we can have a lot of influence.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think that money gets you far, obviously, and especially at a national level. And to be clear, we are unapologetically about equitable outcomes. And we feel like November 4 was a big loss for this country. And a lot of that has to do with a long game of money at a local level. But we can definitely win the people game. You know, we really believe that, where we see there is a large majority of people who are really, really concerned about what's happening in this community and happening across the country. They want voice. And it's about finding a collective voice to be able to speak into these issues and organize around them. What we want ultimately is candidates who, when they are faced with special interests that would be detrimental to the community, to go back to those special interests and say, I can't do this because I will get voted out of office, or my constituency will not allow this to happen. I'll hear from them. And that's the kind of accountability that we feel we can provide.
Tanavia, we'll give you the last word.
I think, like I said earlier, I definitely echo Jeremy's sentiment. When I think about the people that we bring to the table, I know for myself, I'm 23, I'm a woman of color. And so oftentimes in my circles, people feel like politics is too beyond their reach. There's this distance between them and the political government, the system, and it's just too difficult to understand. And joining something like a PAC seems so difficult. And I view Equity PAC as a really awesome entry point for those individuals. Maybe you start by just pledging 10 hours, and maybe you walk through your neighborhood and you talk to your neighbors about a candidate that you met at the Equity PAC meeting who you really support. You know, maybe the next year you can give, or the next year you want to run for office. I see us also as a pipeline being developed, and I'm really excited about, you know, the work that we're doing and seeing the way our community has received our efforts.
That's Tanavia Mojay. She's treasurer of Equity PAC. We also heard from Jeremy Moore, who is co-chair. Equity PAC is based in Grand Rapids. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Well, we've been on the road again, visiting shops of artisans of Michigan. This time we were in Lansing at Scott Smith Pipe Organs. Now, Scott Smith repairs, restores, installs, and builds pipe organs, which he says causes a little confusion for some people, like the guy he was talking to at a party.
He thought I was kidding, and he argued with me. He said, no, nobody does that anymore. So I offered to let him come out to my truck and see how many pipes and wind chests I had in there that I was transporting. And he said, you're not kidding. And I think that's really kind of the attitude that many people have.
But yeah, Scott Smith makes a living working on pipe organs. So does his coworker, Joe Granger. Granger went to school for architecture.
I saw the writing on the wall. The market was starting to crash. Everybody was graduating. I was out of work. You know, people in my class, they were lucky to design kitchens at Home Depot. That's what most of them were doing. That's the only job you could get as an architect.
Granger, and Scott Smith for that matter, play the organ. Granger used to drive past the shop on his way to rehearsals.
And one day I just stopped in here, and 10 and a half years later.
Did you make the right choice?
I really did. This job, it's rewarding in the way that you get to bring a dead organ back, bring it back to life, hear it again for the first time, or make it right after it's been neglected for, you know, for decades.
This shop is filled with work. There's a big bellows on the table. That's what makes the air rush through the pipes. It's part of a restoration of an organ at the Masonic Temple in Detroit. There are metal organ pipes, wood pipes, all kinds of pieces and parts, many of them around a century old. And because air makes everything work, much of the guts of these old organs are dirty with coal dust and soot from playing decades during those years of really polluted air in cities. I was poking around the shop, learning about the felt and the leather and the wood, when I spotted something that made no sense to me.
This doesn't look like something I'd see on an organ to me. So tell me what this is, and can you make it work?
Back in the late teens and early 20s, actually through up until about 1930, organs were used extensively to accompany silent films, and it was a new industry. And one of the things that they did was, in order to make the sound more appealing, was to have real sound effects and things. And here we have rebuilt what's called a trap chest for a church in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And so this is a wood block and the castanets, horse's hoofs, and we have a tambourine. And there's various other effects on the thing, and we've rebuilt all of them.
So this would be something that there'd be a key on a keyboard for this.
Every key on the accompaniment will respond when you play rhythmically. Also in the pedal, I mean, it just depends on where it's all assigned via the what we call a relay.
I did recognize the rectangular wood pipes on a shelf. They've been pretty badly damaged at one point, but they look new now. They're tuned with a stopper in one end of the pipe. You just push it down or pull it up a bit to tune the pipe.
These are made to move. I have used toilet wax in here. We've melted it down. And then the good thing about it is it acts as a sealant, but it also acts as a lubricant. And it needs to be tight on these because in order to make that tone fully come to speech, it needs to be like that, and it keeps the stopper handle tight.
Pull the stopper out, boy, it makes a totally different sound.
This phenomena is that when this is in place, the length of the pipe is actually, the speaking length is double of the actual length, and it goes back to...
They've worked on organs all over the state and beyond. Pipe organs such as the one at the Fox Theater in Detroit, which is in need of a full restoration. But Scott Smith says the magnum opus for his shop is the organ at the First Congregational Church in Saginaw.
We were given a project, luckily we were given a project of a Skinner organ. Ernest Skinner is considered by probably most builders as the ultimate organ builder. He was 94 when he died in 1960, and his instruments have had something of a renaissance. It's a traditional organ that's wrapped in an orchestral organ. So in the 1960s, this 1929 instrument, which was a real jewel, just like other Skinner instruments, was altered dramatically, and it was our job to bring it back. So we did a tremendous amount of research, and that meant traveling to six churches. Mm-hmm. And the churches were all so cooperative. They were thrilled that we were in there measuring things, listening, doing
the metal, every little measurement we could possibly get to recreate it exactly as it was supposed to be in the 1920s.
Gave as much detail as we could to the pipe makers, and I think we were pretty successful in bringing it back. It was a huge project, and there are members who still think that they can remember 50 years ago when the organ was the way it was, and they said, "You've given us our organ back." That's all the payment we need, well, other than writing the check.
And here's just a little sample of what that organ sounds like. That is the restoration work of Scott Smith Pipe Organs in Lansing, our latest Artisan of Michigan. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Let's take a look at a couple of examples of government trying to restrict access to information that just might be public information. To help us sort through the issues, we're joined by Ken Sikkema. He's a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. And Darcy McConnell is a former longtime journalist and current president and CEO at McConnell Communications, which operates as a communications strategist for state Democratic causes and clients. Welcome, Darcy.
Thanks for having me.
Ken, there's a bill to exempt audio or video from body cameras worn by law enforcement from access by the public. What's the point of body cameras if the public is restricted from seeing the recordings?
Well, this is a big issue here. The question that the bill attempts to address is when should body cam recordings be subject to public disclosure and when not? And it's the public's right to know, in fact, need to know, versus rights of personal privacy. And the reason there's a personal privacy issue, I think, is because there are some occasions, not the sort of horrific examples of police abuse we've seen recently, but there are some occasions where you could argue that should be private. You know, if you see suspicious activity in your neighborhood and you call the police and they come to your house to interview you, you might want that to be private and not subject to public disclosure because of fear of retaliation. But that's the issue here, is the public's right and need to know versus times when there's a right to personal privacy.
Darcy, there's also been a fair amount of concern about the cost of keeping body cam recordings on file, departments being inundated with requests for access for those recordings, and that those recordings might be used out of context. What do you think about those concerns and the one that Ken mentioned?
I mean, I think the real problem here is that it creates a slippery slope, which means, you know, it just gives too much option to say, well, you know what, this is exempt on this case and that case. And the reality is these cameras, whether they're body cams or otherwise, are really helpful in showing both sides of the issue. We certainly see instances where it wasn't until the footage emerged that there was a different narrative being built. And if I understand the legislation properly, it sounds like everyone but the working press could get the video, and those are really our watchdogs. So to me, I don't see the gain by having something like this on the books.
One thing I want to add is what I find quite interesting about this bill, and I agree with Darcy, there's kind of a slippery slope issue here, but what I find interesting is this bill is not necessarily partisan, nor is it a suburban versus urban issue. It's actually introduced by a group of suburban Republicans and Detroit Democrats. Depending on how it gets resolved, there could be some common ground on how to address this issue of the public's right to know versus the right of personal privacy.
Darcy, a left-leaning group, Progress Michigan, has filed a lawsuit to find out how often Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette and his aides used private email accounts to discuss public business. The Republican Attorney General refused a request for the private email, saying the messages don't exist. But Progress Michigan says it has 24 such messages in its possession, and it acquired them through other channels. So here we are with a couple of decades after common use of email, and we're still sorting out what's really private, what's really public business that happens to be on a private email. Why do government officials use private email accounts when they're dealing with government business?
That's a question for folks in government, to be honest, and I think that's the point. We are, like, at the bottom of the heap when it comes to transparency, and to me this is another example of how we need to do better. So when you hold elective office, you have to be accountable for what you do, and, you know, skirting the law by using a private email is really not the way to go. And so if you are, then it's fair game to get those emails, I think. And so I think it's a good thing that they're challenging through a lawsuit, and I think it should serve notice to those folks who have maybe said, oh, you know, I'll just get around it with a private email. Now, if that's public, you're in public office, you're doing the public's business, and they have a right to know.
Ken, I have at least 3 different email accounts, and I don't always pay attention to what I'm doing on what one. Is this just an honest mistake, or is there something more indicative? In other words, they want to use private email to avoid being subject to the Freedom of Information Act.
Well, it's legal to have a personal email account if you're a public employee, but I think it's just essential that if you're going to have public disclosure of emails, then if you use your private email account for public business, that's got to be subject to disclosure. I just don't think there's any question about that. But I will say, Lester, that, you know, I could see where there are sort of occasions where you would innocently get in the gray area, probably mostly around scheduling things. But the bottom line is, if we're going to have a Freedom of Information Act that applies to emails for public business, then if you use a different email for public business, that's got to be subject to disclosure.
That's Ken Sikkema. He's Senior Policy Fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former legislative leader. And we'll hear from Darcy McConnell. She's a former journalist and now runs McConnell Communications, a communications strategist for Democrats. Hey, thanks to both of you and have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.
Yeah, thank you.
The nuclear power industry has a problem. It has no way to dispose of spent nuclear fuel rods, which are high-level nuclear waste. Since 1987, the plan was a facility in Nevada known as Yucca Mountain. The Obama administration basically put that project on hold. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission did complete a safety evaluation report and completed an environmental impact statement last year. Now the Trump administration indicates Yucca Mountain is back on the agenda. In the president's proposed budget, $120 million is set aside for restarting the approval process. Joining me now is Samuel Brenton. He's a nuclear engineer with the American Nuclear Society. That's a group of nuclear industry professionals. There are something like 61 nuclear power plants in the U.S. with 99 reactors. It's unclear to me whether that includes decommissioned plants, but it's safe to say over the past four decades, we've ended up with a pretty significant stockpile of spent fuel rods. Where are they stored?
Spent nuclear fuel is placed at those reactor sites that you mentioned, along with another 15 to 16 stranded sites. So these are sites that had a nuclear reactor on them. There's nothing left on those sites but the nuclear waste. So we've cleaned up the reactor. Everything's left into basically a field, except for there's this concrete pad with dry cask storage, which is basically these tall cylinders of concrete which are encasing the nuclear waste in them. Those sites, along with the other sites at reactors, manage over 75,000 metric tons of nuclear waste.
Whoa, say that again. How much?
75,000 metric tons.
Of spent fuel rods.
Of spent fuel, exactly.
Oh,
that's
wow.
Just spent fuel. The great part about that size is that although that number may seem really, really large, it's excessively dense. You may have something really, really, really heavy and really, really big, but it's not necessarily large in volume. So all of the nuclear waste that is currently stored all over the country, if put in Fenway Field — I'm a MIT grad, so when we talk about these sizes, I like to think of my good days that back at Fenway — would be roughly my height. So about 5'10", maybe 6 foot there in Fenway. All of the field covered would be all of the nuclear waste from all over the country. That's its benefit. It can be stored in a pretty condensed form. Right now, it's separated out over 60 to 70 sites across the country, and that's where our problem starts to begin.
How long are the spent fuel rods radioactive?
It can be radioactive for tens of thousands of years and on the order of possibly even 100,000 years to background radiation. However, that nuclear waste is obviously going to burn really, really hot initially and drop pretty quickly. So within a couple of hundred years, most of the radiation will be gone. But it will still not be safe for the environment to be just standing right next to these nuclear waste facilities. So we need to make sure that we properly encase it in engineered barriers as well.
I know one of the decommissioned power plants near Chicago has spent fuel continued to be stored on the site, and there's little more than a cyclone fence and a security guard watching over it. How safe is it to just let this spent fuel sit in dry casks outside?
Dry casks are pretty astounding creatures in that you can't really just pop them open. There's no like little lid that you just pop open really, really quickly. But they're also only going to store nuclear waste that is self-protecting. It's also, you know, it's radioactive. You don't want to just go and grab nuclear waste because you would die. We don't put a lot of big walls around it because it would take a significant amount of work in order to ever remove this nuclear waste from a nuclear reactor facility. Some of these guards are trained in military-level combat to protect these critical installations. The Department of Homeland Security recognizes these as critical installations and says they need to be protected accordingly. Millions of dollars are spent on security. And yes, I recognize that it may just look like a simple chain fence, but that chain fence is protecting us in a way from this nuclear waste and as well keeping us away from it. You could walk right up to these dry cask storage and put your hand on that concrete and you would be okay because the concrete would keep the radiation from hurting you. But you won't be able to just kind of pick up one of these 10 metric ton dry cask storage pieces, put them in the back of a truck and start driving away, because by the time you would do that, of course, a military level security force would be defending against that kind of intrusion.
A good number of these nuclear power plants are near rivers or lakes. Of the three nuclear power plants in Michigan, two are next to Lake Michigan, one next to Lake Erie. By not having made a permanent decision on a national high-level nuclear waste repository, we've basically made a decision to store the waste next to big bodies of water. How is that the industry's best choice?
I would argue that it is not the industry's best choice, but rather the government's failure that has brought us to that point. The government was supposed to pick up this nuclear waste and place it in a location which was deemed geologically and, you know, technically feasible. The problem has been that politically we have not been able to provide that location. And because of that, the utilities literally sue the government for their ability to properly store this nuclear waste. When you see those dry casks around the country, you as a taxpayer have paid that rather than the nuclear industry paying it, because the government has failed. And when the government fails, it falls on the backs of the taxpayers to provide a solution.
Stop there for a second, because you're bringing up a point. Why in the world did the Nuclear Regulatory Commission allow nuclear power plants to go into operation if they had no place to put spent rods, this nuclear waste?
Yucca Mountain was a solution. Everyone, when they started these reactors, assumed that there would be a solution, and we were, as a nation, moving on our way toward that. The reason that the government signed these contracts was that it expected in 1998 to start picking up this nuclear waste from around the country and placing it in Yucca Mountain. Now, obviously, that didn't happen, and that was a failure on their part, but I don't think that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission expected that. But you bring up a really great point, which was the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has been asked, where is your confidence in the ability of the country to provide a nuclear waste solution? They have four times now been questioned about this and have provided what they call waste confidence, that they believe that in the future a nuclear waste solution will be provided. In the meantime, dry cask storage is a way of storing it. I didn't mention this, but of course, every reactor also has what is called wet storage. So wet storage is a pool that happens for the first few years after it's come out of directly out of a reactor. These pools are over 40 feet deep, and nuclear waste is placed in the bottom of them to cool down, as well as to make sure to protect the environment from radiation. So we even place nuclear waste in water to make sure that it will stay cool and away from radiation. We do not want this in the Great Lakes, of course, and so that's why we provide dry cask storage after it has been cooled down to make sure that this nuclear waste remains away from the environment.
And what happens to that liquid waste?
Water itself can't become radioactive. It could be the materials inside of it. So you can, anything that would be used in this water can obviously be filtered out. That filtration will become radioactive, and that's actually low-level waste. That is something that can be sent in a form to a low-level waste site or an intermediate-level waste site as well, depending on how radioactive it gets. So that filtration is something that needs to be managed, but the water itself won't necessarily get radioactive.
Gotcha. If Yucca Mountain is licensed to be the repository for this nuclear waste, those 99 reactors around the nation would have to ship that high-level nuclear waste by truck or by rail. What kind of precautions have to be taken when you're transporting that across the country to Nevada?
A lot of my peers will tell me, well, we've been transporting nuclear waste for decades around the country with no radiation releases and no accidents that have hurt the public. But that doesn't mean anything, because we're about to do a lot more. This isn't going to be something small moving from one site to another. This is going to be moving across the country to a disposal site. So how do we prepare for that? We make sure that the people working in emergency preparedness, for example, your firefighters and your doctors along the route, know what could happen and what the situation could be. We also make sure that they are trained. So the government has been doing this for a long period of time from Navy nuclear waste. So Navy fuel in the submarines is obviously nuclear fuel and needs to be disposed of. So that's been being transported across the country for decades. And the way they've been doing that is making sure that the people in the community are being prepared for what could happen if something goes wrong.
So what could happen?
Let's assume that a truck carrying a nuclear waste canister is hit by another truck. That canister, which has the nuclear waste, could be on fire for hours without a radiation release. So we're pretty lucky about that. But if something were to happen, and let's say there would to be a radiation release, that would obviously be very, very difficult and very, very bad for the environment and the local community. So what do? We make sure that the nuclear waste being transported is a small enough amount. So you have to do more trips, but you have a small enough amount that it will not create a large radiation release. Second of all, you make sure that it's in a form that it won't just drip out of a canister and possibly, you know, fall into a local river or a local lake. These are solid pieces of metal that are obviously radioactive and shouldn't be touched, but are a lot harder to all of a sudden, you know, just drop into a local water body. However, of course, if it caught on fire, that would get into the air. We don't want that to happen. So what do? We put these in canisters that are able to be on fire for hours, submerged under tens of feet of water and hundreds of feet of water in the short term. We also have literally, and I encourage people to look at these videos, you can hit these directly head on with a train, and the train is the thing that takes the battering. So we have supra protected these nuclear waste canisters because we recognize that the risk is present, and we want to make sure that that radiation does not hit the local community. If that happens, the local personnel, the firefighters and doctors, are going to be prepared. We've trained them on how to properly manage this, but we don't want them to ever have to use that preparation.
I have one question about who's notified. You said some of the emergency response people will be notified, but would the public know that they're on the route of this nuclear waste?
Not necessarily. And here's why. Partially because of national security reasons. If, for example, you are a terrorist and you wanted to blow up a truck of nuclear waste, it may not be best for you to know exactly when it is going to be happening. Now, people will know if they are on the route. They will not know when that nuclear waste is coming. There's a difference. There is something to be said for the national security implications of someone with bad intent being able to know the exact location of a train or truck with nuclear waste on it. You as a community member should know that it is going through your community, but you should not know necessarily when it is going through your community, although the governor and local authorities will know that in order to be better prepared.
Samuel Brenton is with the American Nuclear Society. Thanks for talking with us about high-level waste.
Always my pleasure.
To hear an extended version of my interview with Samuel Brenton, you can go to stateside at michiganradio.org. And that's our show for today. Good Friday for those who mark it. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.